This is the North Carolina Reading Service, and the following program is a presentation for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's the Independent Indie Week. I'm John Fetterson for our weekly issue, dated today, the 20th of August of 2026. And here we go. All right, this will be definitely different from my usual broadcasts of Indie Week, in that there are very few, relatively few articles that make frowny faces or serious glances at the screen when I'm reading this, and they're lighthearted or more of a general interest background, and I have one or two of them, and the first one is called The Best Sandwich in Durham That I Can't Tell You About. And it goes this way. The first rule of the super secret sandwich pop-up, don't talk about the super secret sandwich pop-up, SSSP. The chef behind the month-long covert operation happening in downtown Durham said at an August 17th event to the crew of sandwich hopefuls I was gathered with, waiting for lunch, "Everyone spread the word, but keep it hush-hush. But if you post pictures, tag us." Well, I don't want to be hush-hush, though, because these sandwiches are the best I've had in a long time. And while I've been sworn to semi-secrecy about the inner workings of the SSSP, if you happen to follow the breadcrumbs so that you too can experience the sandwiches, that's not really my fault, is it? This week was the first iteration of the month-long pop-up, which is the brainchild of a well-known Durham chef who may or may not help helm Cheney, a restaurant which also happens to be the sandwich pickup spot. For the occasion, this chef has roped in her mother, who also may or may not be associated with said popular Indian restaurant. The chef of her decision to venture into sandwich making. It's honestly one of those things that was just very serendipitous and kind of fun. I was driven by the desire to do something fun and silly for a month, and I was trying to think of something that's accessible and approachable, and sandwiches are what came to mind. She also mentioned that Cheney, that's spelled C-H-E-E-N-I, like a lot of restaurants in downtown Durham, has been slower than usual for this time of year. Doing the pop-up series is a way to try to offset the lag. What I love about this endeavor, outside of the sandwiches, is the commitment to the bit. All of the pop-up social media posts are written as if someone's been investigating what's going on, like they're a spy for sandwich enthusiasts in the Triangle. There's been no marketing for it, just word-of-mouth chatter and fans sharing Instagram stories, which has kept the pop-up more of a secretive, if-you-know-you-know type of situation. And then there's the actual act of getting your hands on one of these bad boys, which will require some sleuthing on your part. There's a link on their Instagram account to pre-order sandwiches each week, but the website is password-protected. To get that coveted code, you'll need to watch for the SSSP's Instagram story Thursday or Friday each week for an invitation to a side chat. This is where you'll be granted the password for their website and alerted when your pre-orders are live. It feels a bit like solving an escape room challenge when you successfully hit the add to cart button, and the joy I felt finishing my quest to order a sandwich felt pretty great. Having such a surprise and delight moment when information is otherwise so readily available this days is a treat. It reminded me of buying a ticket for one of Snap P's pop-up dinners and giddily opening my email to find out where the dinner would be hosted. Or those unexpected pop-up surprise collaborations Delafia has been doing. The chef said whatever we can do to bring people together is ultimately at our core. Now, for the sandwiches themselves, there are five different options to choose from. I couldn't choose between the Makhani melt with buttered chicken, sandwiched between two slices of focaccia bread made by a very popular Durham grocer you've probably waited in line for, or the smashed samosa Sammy, SSS. That's a soft sub roll stuffed with a slightly spicy samosa filling. Naturally, I got both and have no regrets. Each of them were flavor bombs that I'll think about long after the pop-up is over. There's also a chicken salad and a chopped cheese option that fellow fans are raving about. Now, the SSSP will be open Monday through Wednesdays until September the 17th. That's right, folks, September the 17th. While the chef said there are no immediate plans to extend the pop-up shelf life with their current bread collaborator, she'd love to keep it the good times rolling. She said if anybody wants to hop on the super secret sandwich train and wants to talk about a collaboration, definitely reach out. So I'll just reiterate, it's a well-known Durham chef, or may or may not helm Cheney. And they have an Instagram account to pre-order sandwiches each week. Thursday or Friday, you go to the Instagram story, and you get an invite to a side chat. And there, you get the password for the website and a way to pre-order your sandwich. She didn't mention the cost of this in this article of these sandwiches, but I assume they're affordable. And that's it for this one. Well, it must be somewhere at or near lunchtime here at the studios, and that's why I keep turning up food and beverage articles. And here I go with the next one, coffee, secret coordinates, and $27, more secrets. One Triangle Social Club's key helps people keep showing up. Want to grab coffee? Asked this, you'll probably rendezvous at a local cafe or a Starbucks down the street. Now ask Rob Deaton this same question. He'll send you coordinates. This is the premise for Secret Spot Coffee Club, an event Deaton hosts as the founder of Ripple Social Club. Ripple Social Club, a meetup group for people in their 20s and 30s looking for community across the triangle. Inviting members to the monthly coffee event, he sends coordinates to attendees 24 hours before the meetup begins with only two things on the packing list. Bring a mug and a sense of direction. Here the fun begins. Maybe the meetup might be a creek off the trail at William B. Umstead State Park. Or maybe, as it is today, it's a two-mile hike to an abandoned cabin at Eno River State Park. Either way, Deaton offers the same reward, fresh drip coffee, new community, and conversation. For today's meetup, I've bushwhacked through dirt trails, snaked along the Eno, with one hand holding my mug and the other clutching my phone as I come closer to the pin drop displayed on Google Maps, 100 feet to my destination. I roam off the path through a field of weeds as the cabin unveils itself underneath the park's towering oak trees. Four of the club members stood in front of the structure's ramshackle door as they surrounded Deaton, who, crouching down, reached for my mug and poured me a drip coffee. For the Raleigh native Deaton, who also runs a junk removal company called Junk Daddy, this event pays homage to the jobs he held and cities he lived in before moving back to the Triangle earlier this year. He says, "The guide business that I ran in D.C. for backpacking and kayaking was very targeted towards 20s and 30s crowd that found themselves in a new city because D.C. is so transient." He had moved to the Pacific Northwest after D.C., where he took up mountaineering and climbing. Still, hiking with only one or two people at a time caused him to crave more connection. So when he decided to move back to Raleigh, he was motivated to find community. To do so, he realized that his goal could come through helping others find community as well. Quote, "I think a big problem is the consistency of showing up." though many credit the pandemic with being a root cause for increasing feelings of loneliness and isolation, the trend has only continued to rise in the years since, especially among young adults. According to a report from Harvard Graduate School of Education Making Caring Common Project, 24% of people between 18 and 29 years of age reported serious feelings of loneliness, while the rate for 30 to 44-year-olds is even higher, at 29%. Such feelings of isolation also play out in the Triangle, which is one of the top 10 fastest-growing metro areas in the country, with the Wall Street Journal ranking Raleigh in its top 5 hiring hotspots for recent college grads. Still, despite this influx, Triangle transplants often feel disconnected. A wave of social clubs have popped up across the nation in response to these loneliness trends, with platforms like Meetup becoming more popular. Still, it's hard to stay connected. Deaton built Ripple Social Club as a remedy to this collective struggle. It has frequent group events, a meet-and-greet dinner every Wednesday, volleyball or cycling on Thursdays, a pottery club every other Friday. Creating consistency became key when he began building this club's infrastructure. Quote, if you keep seeing the same people that you are interested in seeing, if you have an easy way to just keep seeing those people, the friendships and those relationships and community naturally build over time. When I started this, I wanted to make that easy for people. Still, the element of the club model that Deaton said is most crucial to maintaining social momentum is also its most controversial, a paid membership. Ripple has a $27 per month membership fee to join the members-only events that the club hosts. And when Deaton posted about the club on a local Reddit forum several months ago, the pushback was immediate, with comments like, monetizing social clubs? That's the answer to the loneliness epidemic? Well, Deaton said his decision to integrate a membership fee boiled down to two factors, accountability and quality. Quote, I think that for a lot of free events, whether it's true or not, people interpret them as being low value and don't mentally invest in showing up at all, and if they do, they don't put in effort to make it a good event. He said he cited accountability as something that helps people keep showing up, like a gym membership. With the fees, Deaton said he's able to pay for things like hosting leathercraft workshops, buying drip coffee for the Secret Spot Coffee Club, and organizing dinners without members incurring any additional payment. His philosophy isn't idiosyncratic. The club's 80 members who pay the monthly subscription system seem to agree, especially those who made the hike for July's Secret Spot Coffee Club. There's Akash Jain, who, leaning against a tree and mug in hand, moved to the Triangle 3 years ago. He's been to a handful of meetup events, but seeing Ripple's approach of repeatedly bringing the same group of people together in intimate settings attracted him toward the club. He feels that Deaton's paid membership model is justified. Quote, if it's free, it's open to everyone, and thousands of people can join. They're part of the group, but they're not contributing. They're not showing up. It's too much dilution in your membership. If it's paid, then you have a focus group. Then there's Heather Acock, who calls Ripple the exact community she was looking for when she moved to the area in December 25. With a subscription, she believes she's getting the chance to meet other people intentional about finding community. And she said, there's also social meetups that have happened outside the formal Ripple community as a result of being connected. She pointed across to Jane, who brought a few members like herself to salsa dancing classes where they made more friends, who became part of the social club as well. It's kind of formed really organically in some ways. Taking initiative to meet outside of these scheduled events is what Deaton calls the secret sauce to what he hopes to accomplish with the club. And he said, we have scheduled events like volleyball and pickleball, but people in the group step up and say, hey, let's do a cookout, or let's go take a salsa class together. That's where the dynamic shifts and people change to actually bonding at a real friendship level. Everyone needs community, and that's how you will get better. It's about the consistency of showing up and plugging in, whatever that is. Well, I'm having a ball reading these articles, these lighthearted articles right at the beginning. Here's a little more serious one, but still with some good social values. How local music fans and venues stand to win from new legislation. Anyone who's tried to attend a Beyoncé concert, BTS, or more recently the Carolina Hurricanes, knows it can be nearly impossible to get tickets, thanks to bots. Face value tickets are often snapped up seconds after they go on sale, only to be resold by third parties for 10 or even 100 times their original price. The Real Tickets, Real Fans Act, passed as part of the state budget in early July, aims to regulate predatory ticketing practices across North Carolina. But consumers aren't the only ones benefiting from this legislation. Beloved Triangle independent music venues like Cat's Cradle and Motorco Music Hall also stand to see significant benefits. Online ticketing chaos and prohibitively expensive resales are often associated with massive international events like Taylor Swift's Eras Tours. But Josh Whitman, a partner at Motorco Music Hall in Durham, told Indy this is not just an arena problem. Ticketbox have gotten so efficient that all they're trying to do is skim and flip a ticket. It doesn't matter what size venue you're talking about, it happens at every level. Bots are generated and used by a wide variety of people, from individual scalpers to luxury travel agencies trying to get VIP access to an event for clients. Often, however, bots are used by ticket brokers or the operators of ticket resale websites to turn a profit. The new act outlaws bots, including software that bypasses security measures aimed at protecting fans. It also outlaws speculative ticket sales, prohibiting resellers from offering tickets they don't have or selling multiple copies of the same ticket. Yes, I would prevent that. The NC Department of Justice and Attorney General Jeff Jackson are tasked with enforcing the law by investigating complaints from fans, artists, venues, or others. Companies found to be at fault are subject to fines in the tens of thousands of dollars. Unlike larger corporate-owned venues, places like Motorco don't have millions of dollars in revenue to make up for losses caused by these predatory ticketing practices. Like most independent venues, the music hall relies on the sale of food and drinks during shows, so the number of fans in the room directly impacts their bottom line. When bots buy tickets en masse, it locks fans out of the show. Heather Lagarde, owner of the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapahaw, told the Indy. Say, for example, a bot, perhaps used by a ticket resale company or broker, buys 100 tickets. They're resold at such a markup that the company can still make a profit even if they only resell 10. That leaves still 90 on the market, still too expensive for the average consumer to afford. Now, the speculative ticket sales also mean fans can end up with a fake ticket or without a ticket at all, even though they paid for one. And ultimately, it all adds up to more empty seats at the venue, even if 100% of the tickets were sold. Lagarde says it's just so dangerous for small independent venues, it can really make or break some of them. If you have a small room, we're a 750 capacity room, and 100 people aren't there, it's a financial hard hit. That's on top of the financial challenges independent venues are already facing, with inflation increasing, operating costs, rents rising, and the decreasing in alcohol sales. In recent years, several local businesses and venues have closed across the Triangle, including Sea Grace, the Green Monkey, and Missy Land's Assembly Room. The National Independent Venue Association, NIVA, says across the state only 29% of independent stages were profitable in 2024. It's a similar story for artists who rely heavily on the sale of merchandise like T-shirts and records, said Lagarde. The fewer people in the room, the harder it is to keep the door open and the music playing. Whitman of Motoco echoed that sentiment and said even a shortage of 30 people can mean losing $500 to $1,500 in revenue. Not to mention, none of the excess money made off resale tickets is going to the musicians or artists, many of whom, especially the smaller acts touring at independent venues, are already operating on a shoestring budget. Independent venue owners agree the act is a good step, but say enforcement and education will be key. The Real Tickets, Real Fans Act is similar to legislation enacted in Maine, Vermont, and most recently Washington, D.C. Those laws, however, go a step further by setting a cap on resale prices. Ticketing reforms have also been proposed recently in California and New York. In the past years, several companies have been compelled to pay fines or reach settlements after they were sued by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, FTC, over alleged violations of the federal Better Online Ticket Sales, that's the BOTS Act, good for you, Better Online Ticket Sales. In 2021, three New York companies agreed to a settlement of $3.7 million after allegedly using ticket bots to buy tens of thousands of sick tickets, which were then resold to fans for millions of dollars. Earlier this year, ticket broker Elite Events agreed to pay $300,000 after SET alleged they, quote, used a variety of unlawful tactics to bypass purchasing limits and resold those tickets on the secondary marketplace at a significant profit. More well-known ticket resellers like StubHub, SeatGeek, and Vivid Seats have also faced federal and class action lawsuits over allegations of deceptive ticket pricing and, in one case, selling tickets they didn't actually have. Nick Walters, owner and general manager of the Poor House, P-O-U-R, house in Raleigh, argues that any money made from fines imposed by the Department of Justice should go back into the venues or towards reimbursing artists or fans. But first, a complaint has to be filed. Many fans aren't aware of the illegitimacy of third parties involved in the sale or resale of tickets. According to Lagarde, often fans show up at the venue door unaware the ticket they're holding won't get them into the show, she added. Quote, they believe they bought it legitimately through you because the fake websites are so good. It puts you in the line of fire with your beloved fans who think you have betrayed them when you've had nothing to do with it, and you might not have a way to solve it for them. The Real Tickets, Real Fans Act gives people a way to file actionable complaints through the North Carolina Department of Justice. Still, it's important for venue owners to keep educating patrons about bad actors, said Whitman. For small business, trust is key, and losing that trust, while intangible, definitely hurts venues. And Whitman said, we deal with the emotional fallout of all this, and oftentimes it's very, very difficult to get a person that is being denied entry into show to understand why, and oftentimes they blame the venue. Walters echoed that statement. Quote, there's a lot of misrepresentation, which leads to fans thinking we're just behaving in bad faith and trying to deceive them. The trust of our customers, just like any small business, is paramount to us being able to continue doing business. Walters and others are members of the National Independent Venue Association, NIVA. That's a professional organization that is also advocates for ticketing reform. For more information about the organization, you can visit this website, Fix the Ticks, F-I-X-T-H-E-T-I-X, fixthetick.org. Again, fixthetix.org. All right, we should hit a serious, completely serious article from Durham. Civil rights groups argue no contact order violates a Durham activist's First Amendment rights. Several organizations, including the ACLU, are asking a state appeals court to throw out a no-contact order against Amanda Wallace, a Durham activist accused of harassing a county official. The appeal contends that the no-contact order issued in December on behalf of Durham County Department of Social Services Director Maggie Clapp violates the First Amendment twice, once by curbing Wallace's speech and movement in response to protected criticism of a public official, and again by drawing those limits so vaguely that Wallace can't tell what's forbidden, thus casting a chilling effect over her advocacy work as a whole. Wallace runs an organization called Operation Stop CPS that advocates for child protective services reform. At protests, she frequently likens family separation practices to kidnapping and genocide, terms she has said match the severity of what families endure when the system takes their children. According to the no-contact order, in the year before that order was issued, Wallace repeatedly confronted Clapp in ways that left the director fearing for her safety, intercepting her outside the DSS building and calling her a kidnapper, chalking messages like "Maggie Clapp commits genocide" on the street near her apartment, and disrupting a foster care adoption event that Clapp attended. The order, which is effective until this December, bars Wallace from entering Clapp's apartment building and from traversing the streets and sidewalks adjacent to it. It also bars Wallace from contacting Clapp by phone, and while it allows her to email Clapp, it forbids, quote, abusive, threatening, and harassing language in those emails. Wallace's appeal, filed Thursday by the ACLU of North Carolina, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Movement for Family Power, asks the State Court of Appeals to vacate that no-contact order. Central to the appeal is the claim that Wallace's criticism of Clapp is protected political speech and as such cannot be used as the basis for a no-contact order. The appeal separately challenges how the order is written, arguing its restrictions are undefined to a point that forces Wallace to forego her broader advocacy work for fear of violating terms she doesn't understand. Specifically, the order bars Wallace from, quote, abusing or injuring, unquote, Clapp or the county, without defining what that means, leaving her unable to gauge what she can and can't say, states this appeal. The order also leaves some level of ambiguity to its geographic limitations, according to this appeal. That's particularly notable because Clapp Apartment sits next to Durham Central Park, a public forum. Compounding the ambiguity issues, notes the appeal, is an exchange at the hearing where the order was granted, when Wallace's lawyer asked the judge, James T. Hill, to clarify certain restrictions. Hill gave specific oral instructions that never made it into the written order. For instance, Wallace should avoid directing the term kidnapper at Clapp, but remains free to use such language against the Social Services Department generally. Finally, the appeal argues the county misused the statute it invoked, in obtaining this no-contact order. That's a workplace violence law originally passed to protect victims of domestic violence from harassment at their work. Adina Marks-Arpadi, an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, said in a release, "At its core, this case is about whether public officials can weaponize a statute intended to protect survivors of intimate partner violence at their workplace against their constituents in order to silence speech they find uncomfortable and suppress a movement they dislike. They cannot." Wallace worked as a child protective service investigator in North Carolina for 10 years before founding Operation Stop CPS in 2021. Her dispute with Clapp closely parallels a class she had with the former Durham DSS director, Ben Rose, in 2022. That year, Rose obtained a no-contact order against Wallace under this same Workplace Violence Prevention Act, seeking to bar her from protesting at his home, DSS office, and the courthouse. Hill, who handled that case as well, upheld the order, but allowed Wallace to continue protesting under certain limits. Finally, Wallace has been involved in other disputes with local government as well. In December, she was banned from Durham City Hall after disrupting the swearing-in of newly elected Durham City Council member Matt Kopeck. The city manager lifted that ban in January after an appeal hearing. Wallace was also charged with second-degree criminal trespass in Person County last year in a case brought by then-Person County DSS Director Carlton Paylor, who alleged Wallace entered and remained on his property after it was posted against trespassers. That case is set for a jury trial this month. All right, next, a quite serious subject, transgender. And I'm reading this, although the film, which is talked about, was played in Durham at the Carolina Theater, most recently August the 18th, at various times. And as far as I can read from the article, it's not scheduled to be re-shown, but this is an article about with the film's makers. And the title of that film, What Will I Become? And there was the Out South Queer Film Festival at Carolina Theater between the 13th and the 18th of August. And this is the article. When he would get home from school in the afternoon, one of the first things 14-year-old Kyler Prescott would do would head to the family pool to check for bees in the water. If there were any, he'd fish them out and rest the insects on nearby flowers so their wings could dry. This moment of supreme gentleness is shared by Prescott's mother, Catherine, in What Will I Become? That's a new documentary making its North Carolina premiere at the Queer Film Festival. It's one of many such tender moments in the documentary with an otherwise very dark subject matter at its core, the high rates of suicide among trans boys. The American Academy of Pediatrics, in their 2018 study, found that more than 50% of transgender boys have attempted suicide. Since that study, there's been a flurry of executive orders targeting the trans community, and in particular transgender youth seeking gender-affirming care, and experts warn mental health issues have likely worsened. Directed by Lexi Bean and Logan Rosos, with Harper Steele from Will and Harper as executive producer, What Will I Become? Humanizes this statistic with a loving look back at the lives of Prescott and Blake Brockington, two trans teenage boys who died by suicide in 2015. The film already saw a world premiere at Berlinale, where it won two juried prizes, including the Amnesty International Film Award. But the North Carolina premiere holds special significance. Brockington was from Charlotte and may be recognizable as East Mecklenburg High School's 2014 Homecoming King, the first openly transgender person to wear that crown in the state, a historic win that drew headlines and support, alongside threats and harassment that wore Brockington. The two teens, as depicted in the film, had fairly different personalities. Brockington, who died at 18, was goofy and charismatic, a go-getter. Prescott, who lived with his parents in San Diego and was a few years younger, was soft-spoken, poet, gifted pianist, and animal lover. The two also had overlap. Both loved playing music and had come out early in their teenage years. Both suffered from deep depression. What Will I Become? Stitches together footage of Brockington from Brockington. That's a documentary about his homecoming experience, alongside long interviews with Prescott's parents. You truly ache for his family in this film, and both teens' peers and mentors, including Brockington's high school rugby coach. In one touching moment, the filmmakers commission a group of queer and trans musicians to put a poem by Prescott to music and perform it. Quote, "My mirror does not define me, not the stranger that looks back at me. My body does not define me." Design devices in documentaries can sometimes feel overdone, but What Will I Become draws them in to poignant effect, filling the gap that suicides leave behind. Brockington, a self-identified Tumblr teen, the handle was at brownieboymagic-blog, often processed his feelings online. Several sequences feature the Tumblr status box, sentences flashing, backspacing across the screen, as Brockington navigates the mixed way his family and the world handled his identity, and hesitantly grapples with the pain lurking below his bubbly exterior. The co-directors, who are both trans masculine and suicide survivors, play important guiding roles in the film. Several scenes take place in a blanket fort-like enclosure lit softly with string lights, where they process the interviews alongside their own experiences. Quote, "When you first came out as a trans boy, what did you want to become?" The care with which both doc directors handle painful interviews immediately stands out in the film, an example of the professional acuity that has earned this film accolades, yes, but also of the kind of keen, rare sensitivity that will leave you wanting to be more open, attentive, and kind to the people and creatures around you, and also to yourself. Brockington's summer band camp teacher, Jessica, said in one interview, "When he's talking, people listen. He's the kind of person who makes you want to be better." That's a takeaway that holds true of how viewers will feel about both boys upon watching, but also about the film itself. And once again, that film, which is done playing for now in the Durham area, What Will I Become? The filmmakers plan to take it to Charlotte sometime later this year. Well, now, Indie Week publishes periodically a series of character studies about familiar faces around the triangle and the stories you may not know about them. And here's one, Coke Arail, R-A-L, A-R-I-A-I-L, Coke Arail, urban boat captain. Tucked away in a small cove inside a sea of parking on Ramsur Street in Durham are a pair of nautical vessels covered by tarps. The boats are docked next to a two-story brick apartment. The boat's captain is Durham native William Coke Arail III, artist, craftsman, and film producer. Over the past 2 years, passers-by in that surface parking lot behind Toast and Ruby's on Five Points may have caught a glimpse of Arail working on his most recent ship, a 12-foot scamp, short for Small Craft Advisor magazine project. It's a sailing dinghy. A jovial 83-year-old with a scraggly white beard and youthful exuberance, Ariel, who also owns and lives at that apartment, would fit right in on Gilligan's Island or aboard the Black Pearl. Sailing dinghies are small recreational boats that have been used for hundreds of years, typically powered by wind sails or a small motor. Novice sailors find cruising dinghies to be easy to navigate because of their stability. Some more advanced riders engineer their boats for racing competition. The scamp-style dinghy was developed in 2010 by Craig Wagner and Josh Colvin, publishers of the Small Craft Advisor magazine, with the help of a boat designer from New Zealand, John Welsford. At first, only the boat's designs were available, but now interested sailors can buy pre-made kits or fully built boats. Arail had this to say, "I saw scamp sailing dinghies online. I just fell in love with it. But I need three boats like I need a hole in the head." He first got his sea legs in 1980 after moving from Durham to Virginia near the Chesapeake Bay, where he took a job as a contractor for a telephone company. He rented a small home from the owner of a marina that was about 100 yards from the water, Ariel said, and after seeing a few boats for sale in a car and truck trade magazine, he took the plunge. He bought a Cal 21 recreational keel boat made of fiberglass for $3,000. That was the first boat in his fleet, and a how-to-sail instruction manual. Those are quite useful. He moved back to Durham in 1983 and bought his apartment during a time when downtown Durham was occupied mostly by day laborers looking to pick up work. In the decades since he first purchased the Cal 21, he's owned 5 boats in total. A 28-foot Southern Cross he called Sweet Dreams that was destroyed in 2011 by Hurricane Irene. A 12-foot car topper sailing dinghy that he built and named Katie Did, after his second wife Katie, whom he married on Sweet Dreams. A Bayfield 25 keelboat he keeps docked in Oriental, called the Pungo Pearl. And now, of course, the Meerkat Snug, the name of portmanteau of mermaid and cat, his newly minted scamp sailboat. This particular model of scamp boats can retail for as high as $20,000, Ibriel said, completely built out and furnished, but the plans to design it yourself were only a couple $100, a drop in the bucket, comparatively. I think a drop in the bucket might be the wrong word to talk about boat building, however. Ariel, who retired in 2011 after working for over a decade as a film producer with the Veterans Affairs Office in Washington, D.C., had the time to sink his teeth into a new project. Serving as Ariel's first mate throughout the process was his stepson, Charlie Engel, a renowned ultramarathon runner who is featured as one of 3 adventurists in a 2007 documentary, Running the Sahara. Engel, who grew up in Southern Pines and now lives in Durham, suggested the two of them tackle the construction of the Meerkat Snug together. Ariel said, "There's no way I can refuse this, because normally, even though he's here, we'd see each other maybe 2 or 3 times a year." After Engel's son was born in 93, Ariel built his grandson a cradle in the form of a model sailboat, the only boat he's built that rocked back and forth by design. "That way, we'd be seeing each other at least 2 or 3 times a month." What Ariel saved in cost, he paid for in time, but spending that quality time with his stepson was well worth the trade-off. The Meerkat Snug is made out of birch marine plywood. The outside is layered with fiberglass, and 2 or 3 coats of epoxy on the inside protect the wood from weathering and abrasions over time. Ariel used the stitch-and-glue technique, which he likens to a surgical procedure, weaving large plastic ties to piece together the plywood and hold it in place before sealing them tight and then cutting off the excess ties. "Imperfections," he said, "are unavoidable." "It's the old joke about carpenters," he said, chuckling as he recalled the errors he'd made along the way. "The mark of a good carpenter isn't how many mistakes he makes, but how well he can cover them up. Man, I can't tell you the places we went. Who measured that?" "It takes a modicum of skill, but you don't have to be a furniture-grade craftsman at all." He went scouring in his favorite bamboo patch to find the optimal stalk to make his mast. He was familiar with the tensile strength of bamboo, having grown up near bamboo forests that he would harvest for crafting fishing poles and toy swords as a kid. The Katydid also features a bamboo mast. In 2019, a poem he wrote, Bamboo Wind, was brought to life through an interactive art installation at the Fruit with Bamboo Abound. The bamboo for the Meerkat Snug was treated with fiberglass sleeves and epoxy, similar to the rest of the ship, to prevent that wood from expanding and contracting with seasonal temperature changes. After a few coats of acrylic urethane exterior house paint and a mermaid figurehead affixed to the bow, the Meerkat Snug was completed in a year. She departed on her maiden voyage this past January with Ariel Engel and Durham-based filmmaker D.L. Anderson there to capture that moment on film. At 83, getting the boat out is more tedious than before, but the tranquility of the open waters is a siren call Ariel can't ignore. Floating along the waves at the mercy of Mother Nature's mood swings brings you to be, quote, in the most real sense, one with your environment, he said, and offers him the opportunity for deep reflection, with only the soundtrack of the natural world to underscore his thoughts. And he says, I think people nowadays are uncomfortable with silence. You go into somebody's house and there's a TV on, if not two of them, and they're not in the room, they're not listening, and they're not watching, but they can't bear silence. I like being in company, and I like being with people, but I also need a fair amount of silence. And he continued, on my sailboat, even the big one that's got a motor, I can't wait to get out there, get the sails up, get the motor off, and all you've got is the sound of the birds and waves. To me, it can be so peaceful to allow your mind to clear itself and go wherever it wants to, and I love it. It's like a form of healing and centering and of finding an inner peace. One article to go in this week's issue of Indie Week. I'll probably finish early, and so I will go to my actual online publication, Indie Week, and find something to fill up my space. And another character study, this one of Tiki McIntyre, a Kerry artist who channels spirit guides to paint. When first I arrived at Ikigai Studios and Gallery in downtown Kerry to interview artist Catherine Tiki McIntyre, she was giving an impromptu tour to a man who had wandered into her studio. He was drawn in by the vibrant neons and pastels splashed across her paintings he could see through the window, he said. It was a fitting first impression. Most find McIntyre because her work's striking colors catch their eye at a community art show, or because after wandering away from Bond Brothers East Side, the neighborhood brewery and live music venue, they discover McIntyre painting in her studio late at night. Then people come back for more of her artwork, but also the studio events she hosts, including paint and sips, date night paint nights, belly dancing, poetry readings, summer camps, and interactive commissions. She begins her creative process by meditating or praying to tap into what her guardian angel and spirit guides are urging her to put on the canvas. She also draws from dreams and memories, which is why it makes sense that nearly all her pieces are abstract. She explained this all while I was fighting a glance at the Dolly Parton and Taylor Swift standees looming on a tall ledge above where we sat. She said, it's like something happens in my hands, they just do their own thing. It's the weirdest thing, kind of, ever, she said. McIntyre said one of her favorite abstract pieces is St. Michael, which she got up to paint one night after the prayer of St. Michael the Archangel was roaring in her mind on repeat. The painting resembles a pair of gold wings, which McIntyre said encapsulates the protective energy of the prayer. And though she is a Catholic, she said she had never memorized it. Quote, I usually paint very bright colors, but that painting is creamy colors, pale blues, golds, which I don't know how that happened, except I didn't do it. She explained her process involves channeling energy rather than making deliberate conscious choices. McIntyre, a Duke University licensed health and well-being coach, said she got into wellness working in her father's hardware store as a kid in the 80s, where they sold the nutritional supplement Barley Life. She's been hooked on it since and still swears by it for pain relief and energy. Hailing from New Orleans, McIntyre studied exercise physiology and art at Louisiana State University after discovering those passions in middle and high school. She went on to work as a personal trainer for 17 years, but started taking art classes again after having two daughters in her early 40s. a feat she credited to her affinity for wellness. She said, that was my time for me, you know, to just get back into it. But she said she needed her own space. After moving to the Cary area in 22, she began the search for a studio, quote, that wasn't the third floor of my house with four feral cats that traveled with us here. She found a landlord with the help of her friends at Fine Arts League of Cary, but McIntyre paused before describing how she got her little spot off East Chatham Street. She began, so I had a dream the night my mom died. It wasn't clear where this was going. She set the scene. A large festive family party with her grandfather busy moving belongings about the place. And people are teasing him and saying, Robert, come enjoy the party. He's like, I have to take care of one more thing before this all happens, she recounted. She called her sister to describe that dream just for her to inform McIntyre that their mother had died a few hours ago. McIntyre retold her dream again at her mother's funeral and said she experienced another bout of divine timing or intervention later that day. She said, gesturing to her studio, it's so funny because my phone rang and it was the landlord for this place. I was just sitting down with my aunts, just talking. I answered the phone and then said, oh my God, the landlord just offered me the space. They said, no, it was your mom. Ever since her mother died, McIntyre said fondly, it's like she's all over the place in her studio. She wiped a couple tears from her face and pointed to a nearby photo of her mom. These are the kinds of experiences that drive her to create, she said, and inspire her to memorialize those of others with her Canvas of Memories commissions. Customers come to her studio with their loved ones, bringing notes, ticket stubs, toys, photos, or whatever they want the painting to encapsulate. They put them on the canvas and paint alongside McIntyre, and then she finishes the piece by layering more paint atop it with their intentions in mind. McIntyre said she does these commissions because she wants to help others understand themselves and their life experiences, a kind of meditation which she said has culminated in her favorite works. And she thinks it's serendipitous that she gets to do it in the studio her mother blessed her with. She said, I strongly believe that everything happens for the good. Well, folks, I have to close this issue, but I've just opened up to IndieWeek.com, and right today, before I came to the studio, this is an article from Apex about the utilities balances, which Apex could not collect because of a cyber attack earlier. I probably won't have time to read the whole thing, but I'll give it a shot. About 13% of Apex's 30,000 utilities customers owed money to the town. Apex leaders heard in a work session this week, and on average, residential customers owe about $1,100 apiece. That work session took place 7 weeks after the town's July 1st deadline for resuming collection of late fees and disconnection of services for non-payment after a cyber attack in 2024 impacted the billing system, resulting in higher than normal bills for thousands of customers. Deputy Town Manager Sean Purvis explained to the council members, the town must legally pursue all outstanding payments, but it is committed to treating utilities customers fairly and consistently and balancing service continuity with collections. That's really what we're focused on. It's about making sure we're understanding our customers' needs, working with them best we can, and still fulfilling our responsibility to the town. To help customers get current on their bills, the town is offering payment plans to all residents and business who owe money on their accounts. That's 498 residential and 10 commercial accounts are already using these payment plans, according to Finance Director John Griffin. That accounts for a balance of about $1,200,000. Of past due balances, the total owed comes to nearly $5 million. That's Finance Director John Griffin. He foresees a number of challenges in collecting the money owed. Staff acknowledge the town is unlikely to recoup all of it, though they didn't provide an estimate of how much could be lost. Some accounts have accumulated large past due balances, The largest sums are about $20,000 for residential and about $40,000 for a commercial account. Some accounts have not been paid since 2024 when the cyber attack occurred. Customers on payment plans could struggle to put monthly payments toward their debt while concurrently paying their monthly utilities bills. If customers don't pay for current usage, they are at risk of disconnection. That's a prospect that worries some council members, as extreme temperatures make cooling during the summer months a necessity. Residents who can't make payments on a monthly payment plan could qualify for the town's Utility Customer Assistance Program based on their income. The nonprofit NeighborUp partners with the town to provide financial assistance to residents, and other state, county, and nonprofit programs are available to help customers pay. Finally, the town is looking at ways to update its 1995 customer service policy to improve efficiency in its service delivery, responsiveness, and collections operations. Some staff recommended changes include allowing payment plans to continue for longer than 12 months, updating a policy that restricts disconnections during extreme weather, and adding flexibility to review customers' compliance before assessing fees or disconnecting services. Well, in record time, I finished that article. Say, folks, John Feddersen again. I've enjoyed reading this particular week because of the, more lighthearted feel and less academic type of reading I usually need to do, and get through all my articles that are backlogged. But I just want to remind everyone that IndieWeek.com is a website from which I bring all these and extract the articles themselves. Of course, absent all the photographs and additional materials that are come in that. But you, the listener, can access this on your own IndieWeek, on your own computers, free, and whatever your reading or listening abilities will allow you to see or experience is available, including this large backlog arranged in formats like legal, etc. Once again, John Feddersen for the North Carolina Reading Service, which provides this program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, will be with you next week for a next weekly issue of The Independent. So long, and thanks for listening.